The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are tackling a really heavyweight contender in political philosophy. It's Robert Nozick's 1974 book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia.
Yeah, this one's definitely a deep dive. It's dense, it's challenging, but honestly, it's absolutely crucial if you want to grasp, you know, the foundations of a lot of modern political debate.
It really is, because Nozick doesn't just sort of give opinions. He builds this incredibly rigorous case against most forms of government action.
That's right. He's essentially asking, is government intervention beyond the absolute basics morally legitimate at all? And his answer is largely no.
Which brings us to the core idea we're exploring, the minimal state. Mm-hmm. He argues anything more than this bare-bone structure is actually immoral.
Exactly. The night watchman state, as he famously calls it, its job is strictly limited, basically, protecting people from violence, theft, fraud, and making sure contracts are honored. That's it. So things like public schools or welfare programs funded by taxes.
According to Nozick, those are illegitimate uses of state power because they violate individual rights, specifically your right to your own property and earnings.
And that's why this book, you know, written 50 years ago, still fuels debates today about taxes, about the welfare state, about where individual liberty ends and, well, collective responsibility begins. It forces you, the listener, to really define your own lines.
So let's talk a bit about the author, Robert Nozick. He was a major figure, taught at Harvard for most of his career. Very influential philosopher.
What really stands out is his method, isn't it? It's not just philosophy. It's like philosophy meets logic puzzles, meets economics.
Absolutely. He uses this intense analytical approach, lots of thought experiments, very precise, almost mathematical reasoning applied to politics. It was quite a fresh perspective.
He wasn't just relying on, say, tradition or intuition. He built arguments.
Right. And you have to understand the timing. He wrote this in 74. And it is a direct response, a really sophisticated counterargument to John Rawls' A Theory of Justice from 71.
Ah, Rawls, the big defender of the modern sort of redistributive welfare state.
Exactly. Rawls provided this powerful intellectual framework for liberal egalitarianism.
Yeah.
And then Nozick comes along and basically says, okay, let's apply rigorous philosophical standards to your assumptions.
So he met the dominant theory head on using its own tools.
Precisely. And in doing so, he gave libertarianism this unprecedented academic weight. He forced philosophers, even those who disagreed, to take the arguments for a minimal state much more seriously.
Okay, so the book itself, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, the title lays out the path. What's the overall goal here? What's he trying to achieve?
Well, the big question is legitimacy. Can any state be morally justified? He's fighting a battle on two fronts, really, against anarchists who say no state is ever okay.
But they're inherently coercive.
Right. And against, well, most other political theorists who argue for a more extensive state, one that does more than just protect rights.
So part one, anarchy, is about proving the anarchists wrong, showing a minimal state can arise legitimately.
Yes, exactly. He argues it can emerge from a state of nature, think John Locke, through purely voluntary steps, like an invisible hand, guiding market exchanges for protection without actually violating anyone's rights along the way.
Okay, then part two, state. This is where he takes on the proponents of bigger government.
This is the core, yeah. He argues the minimal state isn't just a justified state. It's the most extensive state that can be justified. Here, he introduces his entitlement theory of justice and attacks what he calls patterned justice. We'll definitely need to unpack that.
And finally, part three, utopia. That sounds, well, optimistic for a minimal state advocate.
It's a clever move. He argues the minimal state isn't some bleak, empty ideal. Instead, it's a framework for utopia. It's the only system, he claims, that allows all sorts of different communities and individuals to pursue their own versions of a good life, side by side, through voluntary choices. All right, let's dive into part eight properly. How do we get from anarchy, where everyone enforces their own rights, to a state? He starts with Locke, right? Individuals have rights, but enforcing them yourself is messy.
Yeah, it leads to bias, feuds, inefficiency, all that. So people naturally team up.
Exactly. They form mutual protection associations. Think of them like voluntary defense packs. And over time, through competition and efficiency, one association in the given area will likely become the strongest, the most reliable.
The Dominant Protective Association, or DPA.
Right. But here's the key. The DPA is initially just a private company. It protects its paying customers. It's not a state yet.
Because a state claims a monopoly on using force and protects everyone,
right?
Not just clients.
Precisely. So how does the DPA make that leap without becoming, you know, just a bully violating the rights of people who don't want to be its clients, the independents?
That's the puzzle. How does it get a legitimate monopoly?
Okay, Nozick's argument is subtle. The DPA, for the safety of its own clients and the general stability, can prohibit independents from using enforcement procedures that it deems risky or unreliable.
Risky? Like someone trying to enact vigilante justice in a way that might escalate or harm bystanders?
Exactly. The DPA says, look, your methods of self-defense are potentially dangerous to others. You can't do that.
So it restricts their right to self-help. That sounds like coercion.
It is a restriction.
Yeah.
But here's the crucial step.
Yeah.
Because the DPA is prohibiting the independents from exercising their natural right, even if riskily, it incurs a moral obligation to compensate them.
Compensate them how? Money?
No, by providing them with protection services.
Yeah.
Essentially, the DPA uses funds from its paying clients to extend its protective umbrella over the independents as compensation for limiting their self-defense options.
Right. So by fulfilling this obligation to compensate, which arose from a legitimate act of prohibiting risky procedures, the DPA starts protecting everyone in the territory.
Right. And that universal protection, combined with its now justified monopoly on authorizing force, is what transforms the DPA into the minimal state. It happened, theoretically, through voluntary association and morally required compensation, not through conquest or some mythical social contract.
Wow. Okay, that is pretty clever. Avoiding violating rights all the way through.
Okay, now part two. This is where Nozick really throws down the gauntlet on distributive justice. He's rejecting what he calls patterned justice.
Patterned justice. What does that mean exactly? Like everyone gets the same slice of the pie?
It could mean that, or it could mean distribution according to need or merit or effort or whatever. The point is, a pattern theory judges a distribution based on whether it fits a specific end state pattern or formula. Rawls' theory, aiming to maximize the position of the worst off, is a classic example. It looks at the outcome.
And Nozick says, forget the outcome, look at the process.
Exactly. His entitlement theory is historical. It asks, how did people get what they have? There are three parts. Did they acquire it justly from an unowned state, justice and acquisition? Did they get it through a voluntary transfer, like a sale or gift, from someone who was entitled to it, justice and transfer?
Okay, acquisition and transfer. What's the third?
Rectification of past injustice. This is crucial. If holdings were acquired or transferred unjustly through theft, fraud, coercion, then that injustice needs to be corrected.
Given history. You know, colonialism, slavery, land grabs. That rectification principle sounds like it could justify massive redistribution itself, couldn't it?
It's the massive elephant in the room for the theory. Nozick acknowledges this. He basically says, if past injustices are widespread and uncorrected, his theory might require something looking very much like a patterned redistribution just to get back to a baseline where the entitlement principle can actually operate justly going forward. It's a huge caveat.
Okay, putting the massive issue of rectification aside for a moment, let's get to the furthest bit, the Wilt Chamberlain example. Can you walk us through that again? It really crystallizes his point about patterns.
Right. Imagine we start with a distribution of wealth, D1, that everyone agrees is perfectly just. Let's say it's perfectly equal, just for argument's sake.
Okay, perfect justice, D1.
Now, Wilt Chamberlain, the basketball superstar, signs a special contract. For every home game, fans who want to see him specifically can voluntarily drop an extra 25 cents into a box with his name on it. They're happy to pay extra to see him play.
They choose to do it. It's their money.
Exactly. A million fans do this over the season. Wilt now has an extra $250,000. Everyone else has 25 cents less than they would have otherwise. We now have a new distribution, D2. Wilt is way richer.
So D1, the just pattern, is gone. But is D2 unjust?
Nozick's point is, how could it be? Every single step was voluntary. The fans freely gave their money. Wilt freely played under the agreement. No one's rights were violated.
Which leads to his famous line.
Liberty upsets patterns. If people are free to do what they want with their own resources and talents, any preordained pattern of distribution is going to be disrupted.
And trying to maintain that original pattern, D1.
Requires constant coercive interference. The state would have to step in and forbid the 25-cent transactions or forcibly take Wilt's extra earnings away.
Which brings us to Nozick's most intense claim about taxation.
Yes. He argues that taxing earnings, especially for redistribution, isn't just taking money. It's morally equivalent to forced labor.
Wow. Equating income tax with forced labor, that's strong.
It is. His logic is, if you work, say, 40 hours a week and the state takes 25% of your earnings and taxes for programs beyond minimal protection, it's essentially claiming ownership over 10 hours, 25% of your work time each week.
It's forcing you to work part of your time for its purposes, not your own.
Exactly. It treats your labor, your time, your talents as a public resource, violating your fundamental self-ownership. It's a stark conclusion, but it follows directly from his premises about rights and entitlement.
Okay, so besides the step-by-step arguments, what are the really big underlying philosophical ideas driving this whole minimal state vision, the core principles?
Well, the first absolutely fundamental one is individual rights as absolute side constraints. This is very Kantian.
Meaning rights aren't just goals to aim for, they're strict limits.
Exactly. You cannot violate someone's rights, even if doing so would produce a greater good for more people. Individuals are ends in themselves, not means to be used for collective purposes. Rights act like absolute fences around individuals that the state cannot cross.
And that connects directly to the second big one, self-ownership.
Yes. The idea that you own yourself, your body, your mind, your abilities, and therefore, crucially, your labor and what you produce or acquire justly through that labor, this is the bedrock justification for why taking your earnings is wrong.
Okay. Side constraints, self-ownership, and the third would be that core distinction we talked about.
Right. The entitlement theory versus pattern justice. The constant message that justice lies in the history of how things were acquired and transferred, not in the resulting pattern or end state. Process over outcome.
And he takes this quite far, right? You mentioned earlier he even critiques things like equality of opportunity. That seems like a widely accepted good.
He does. Because think about what true equality of opportunity might require. To ensure no one starts with an unfair advantage from, say, their family.
You'd have to intervene quite drastically.
Massively. Nozick argues it could require unacceptable interference in family life, limiting how parents can educate their children, pass on wealth, or instill values. He sees it as violating the liberty of the family unit and the individuals within it, all in the name of enforcing a pattern. You know, some of the most memorable parts of the book are these really punchy lines that just capture these huge ideas.
Yeah, the kind of quotes that stick with you. What are some of the key ones?
Well, the very opening line sets the tone for side constraints. Individuals have rights, and there are things no person or group may do to them without violating their rights. Just lays it out there.
Can't argue with the directness. And the main thesis.
The minimal state is the most extensive state that can be justified. Any state more extensive violates people's rights. That's the core claim.
And the one from the Wilt Chamberlain example.
The most famous. Liberty upsets patterns. Simple, powerful, unforgettable.
And the really controversial one about taxes.
Taxation of earnings from labor is on a par with forced labor. That's the one that still generates the most heat, I think.
Definitely. Is there one more that sort of flips a common phrase?
Ah, yes. His libertarian twist on the socialist slogan. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Nozick reframes it based on voluntary action. From each as they choose, to each as they are chosen. It emphasizes voluntary exchange and gifts over mandated distribution.
So taking these pretty abstract philosophical claims, how do they translate into the real world? What kind of policies would flow from this framework?
Well, quite radical ones by today's standards. You'd see strong arguments for significantly lower, perhaps flat, taxation, definitely reducing progressive income taxes.
Because higher rates on higher earners look even more like forced labor, claiming a bigger chunk of their time.
Exactly. You'd also see pushes for widespread privatization of services currently run by governments. Think schools, roads, maybe even aspects of the legal system through arbitration. And drastically fewer economic regulations, anything that restricts voluntary contracts in exchange. Stronger protections against things like eminent domain for private development, too.
And for businesses and the economy.
It provides a powerful moral defense of free markets and profit. Profit isn't seen as exploitation, but as the just reward for successful voluntary cooperation, risk-taking, and satisfying consumer wants. It encourages entrepreneurship.
What about on a personal level? How might it affect how someone thinks about solving social problems?
It really emphasizes personal responsibility and voluntary action. Instead of looking to the government to fix poverty or inequality, the Nozickian approach would prioritize private charity, mutual aid, and persuasion over political coercion.
And that framework for utopia idea from part three, does that have practical implications?
Yeah, it supports a kind of radical social pluralism. Let different communities organize themselves based on shared values, socialist communes, religious groups, libertarian enclaves, whatever, as long as they're voluntary associations that respect everyone's basic rights, including the right to leave. More local control, more diversity of lifestyles, less top-down imposition.
You know, reflecting on it, the part that intellectually grabbed me the most was that detailed argument in part one. The way he constructs the minimal state out of anarchy through the DPA and compensation, it felt like watching someone solve a complex logic puzzle. Whether you agree with the endpoint or not, the steps were fascinating.
For me, the lasting power of Nozick is how effectively he forces you to take individual liberty seriously as a moral claim. He puts the burden of proof squarely on anyone who wants the state to do more than protect basic rights. You can't just assume state action is justified. You have to rigorously defend every instance of coercion against the claim of self-ownership.
It makes you re-examine things you might take for granted about the role of government. It's a fundamental challenge, really.
It absolutely is. And here's a final thought connecting back to that tricky rectification principle. If we accept Nozick's premise that justice is historical, and we acknowledge the vast injustices, colonialism, slavery, theft that underpin so many current property holdings around the globe, what would genuine rectification actually entail?
You mean how much state action might be needed just to establish the just baseline Nozick himself requires?
Precisely. Could the demands of rectifying past wrongs actually justify a state far more active and redistributive than the minimal one he ultimately defends, at least temporarily? It's a profound question his own theory raises.
A paradox embedded within the argument for minimal government. Something definitely to think about.
Indeed.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.